Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we'll talk about how to find reliable health information online.
These days, when you type in cancer or any type of health condition, you receive thousands upon thousands of links.
Plus, we'll be examining the rise in syphilis cases in central New York.
It used to be mainly male and female, both disease. Now, actually, it's leaned towards mainly predominantly in males, men having sex with men.
And all about stroke and its comprehensive treatment.
What's important about calling 911 is that emergency medical providers can be right on the scene and start treatment and get things moving quickly.
We'll get our checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse. And that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll examine the growing problem of syphilis and what you need to know. Plus, we'll talk all about stroke and its comprehensive treatment. But first, finding reliable health information on the World Wide Web. Don't believe everything you read. Well, it's an old warning that's especially true for health-related information that you might find on the World Wide Web. As internet users quickly discover, there's an enormous amount of health information available online. But finding accurate and reliable information among the millions of online sources is a difficult task for almost everyone. Well, here with some tips and advice as to the best and safest way to navigate the web for credible and trustworthy health information is Christina Pope. She's the director of the Health Sciences Library at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Christina. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So in this world of instant access and Googling, you know, we're all accustomed to getting answers to all of our questions, or at least we think we're getting the right answers. And health questions are really no different. How have you seen this phenomenon emerge over the past few years?
Well, I think you hit the point exactly. Google is part of our challenge. These days, when you type in cancer or any type of health condition, you receive thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands of links. And the trick is to figure out which ones will provide you with reputable, good, high quality information in which you really just need to steer clear from.
Yeah, that there are a lot of myths, opinions, and half-truths out there. And it
exactly.
seems like that's the greatest challenge, especially mm-hmm. for the novice, for the lay person who has no real, you know, medical background. They could be very intelligent, they could be very well educated, mm-hmm. but you really have a problem in understanding or in vetting what it is. Let me step back for a second. In your experience, and you've been, I'm sure, you know, right in on the cutting edge of all of this stuff as a librarian, what efficiencies or strengths now exist that were absent before?
Well, the biggest advantage we have these days is really the quantity of the information that's available to us. The internet it's a gold mine. And these days, much of the health research information is now mandated by the National Institutes for Health and the NSF, the National Science Foundation, to be made available without fee after about a year, maybe 2 years of publication.
Really? That's something I had no idea about. That's very interesting. So there's some real, very credible,
yes.
highly scientific information also made available.
If you can find it.
Oh, well, we're going to talk about
okay.
it. You're going to help us navigate that in just a minute. But so the potential hazards, I think, that exist, I think we've already kind of mm-hmm. illuminated, which is you might be getting information and you might not know, have a way of assessing whether this is in fact fact versus myth or opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So to avoid that, let's walk through some of the tips or things or questions that you should ask yourself.
Sure.
As you go on the web, before, you know, as you alight yourself on some particular site.
Mm-hmm.
what should you be basically saying to yourself?
Well, I think like everything, you need to be skeptical about what you're reading. You don't believe every commercial's claims. You shouldn't believe every website's claims. When you look at that information, you really need to be asking yourself a couple of questions. Who wrote that?
So where it came from?
Where did it come from? Was it paid for? And if so, who paid for it?
So who's sponsoring potentially?
Exactly. So if it's a pharmaceutical company and the information is all about drugs and how they're the best thing to cure whatever condition you might have, you really might want to consider whether or not that website is interested in helping you enhance your health, or if they're more interested in selling you a product. Mm-hmm. So you always need to be looking at that.
How about the issue of the currents, how current the information is? Is there a way to assess that?
There is, and currency is very important. Best practice in healthcare changes all the time. It's one of the biggest challenges we have. And so when you're looking at a web page, you really need to look through that and see if they have a date on it. And the good ones will. They'll say that this was last updated on, and they'll give a date.
Where do you usually find that?
You can find it in a couple of spots. If it's a comprehensive page, and that by that what I mean is if that page provides information on a lot of different conditions, at the bottom of the article or at the top, they'll say last updated on. They should also say by whom it was updated. If it's a page that is all about one thing, it's all about cancer, then there's probably an About Us tab somewhere on that page, either at the top, at the bottom, on the side. Look at it. It should be telling you who wrote it, what the organization is about, how often, what their policies and procedures are, how often do they update things, where do they get their information.
So clearly, who is responsible for this is very important, whether it's published by an organization, whether it's published by an individual, mm-hmm. and who is actually, what's the motivation for publishing
exactly.
this information seems to me to be crucial in the whole process. How can you determine whether the site presents facts versus opinion? Are there clues to that?
There are clues. If the page is created by an individual, so I had surgery and this is all about my experience, that may be great information, but it is about their experience. If the page is authored, let's say, by the American College of Surgeons, that's probably much more factual or evidence-based is what the professions like to call it these days.
Is it also important to try to figure out who the intended audience is? In other words, who is this being directed at?
Yes, that is very important. There are clues. Very frequently, the language itself is a clue.
In other words, whether it's for professionals or consumers,
correct.
For example.
So if you're looking for cancer information, it's very difficult because most of us, if we have cancer, we'll just type in cancer. But the health professions refer to cancer as neoplasms. And if you try it yourself and just type in cancer and then do a new search and type in neoplasms, you'll get two very different responses because neoplasms is what the clinicians call it. It's what our doctors are calling it, our nurses are calling it. But cancer is what we call it. So if you don't understand what you're reading, you need to back off, either consult your clinical care team or look for something else.
So you really need to vet this in some way.
Always.
Continually be vetting it.
Yes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Upstate Health Librarian Christina Pope. And we're talking about how best to find reliable health information while you're surfing the web. Let me get a handle on what do you think are the better websites to go to, the more reliable websites. Right. And we'll have those links to those on our website. That's on HealthLink on Air. That's all one word, .org. And we're going to have those links. So my listeners don't have to write all these down. But so tell us, Christina, where would you go if you were looking for reliable information on a particular health condition?
The first place I would probably go to is Medline Plus. And that's a comprehensive site, and it's created by the National Library of Medicine. So they've already done the vetting for you. They've looked at the quality. They do a lot of the authoring themselves. They are trained professionals. They look at it every day. That is their job. It's a comprehensive site, so you can find information on just about anything, including health information for your pets.
That's very helpful and interesting.
Yep. It's also available in Spanish.
Oh, that's very helpful.
Which is very
well.
Helpful.
Yes.
In addition, sometimes, you know, when you're sick, sometimes comprehension is difficult because you're worried and you're upset. Sometimes your reading is just not there. Even the most highly educated of us, it's hard. On Medline Plus, they'll actually have videos so you can watch things, and they have a voice overlay so you can listen.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's a great, great resource.
So are there others?
There are others. There is a resource called Kids Health, and that's just Kids Health, and it's all about the kids. So if we're not concerned about ourselves, you know, we're generally concerned about our kids. So that's a great place to go.
And as you said, in those cases, both of those are ones that have been well vetted.
Yes.
How about things like WebMD, which always comes up?
Sure.
Or Mayo Clinic, for example?
Well, WebMD, you have to pay for. So you have to wonder about that. With some of the sites like WebMD, the concern with those is how frequently is that information updated? By and large, it can take years for health information best practice to actually get in print, whether or not it's in a magazine, whether or not it's in the newspaper, whether or not it's online. That's one of the big reasons why you always, always have to talk with your clinical care team, because what you read, even though it says 2015, may actually be 2 or 3 years out of date. So that's one of my big concerns with something like WebMD. Mayo Clinic, on the other hand, is a site that's sponsored by the Mayo Clinics. And again, you've got lots of professionals who are always updating that information. It's a great place to start. Anything on the web, by and large, is a great place to start. But the place you need to finish is with your clinical care team.
I think that's a really very crucial point. So what would you avoid? I mean, in all of your experiences as a healthcare librarian, what have you seen any real glaring problems?
The sites that I would avoid really are those personal testimonials. This was my experience. Whatever that experience was, if it was a great experience, they had a great outcome. If it wasn't such a great experience, the thing is, that was their experience. And everybody, and you know this, you look at yourself, you look at your family, we are all very, very different. And things that work for one person don't work for the other person. So much of health treatment these days is very much targeted to the individual.
Very much so. More and more these days.
More and more these days. So I would really, really avoid those personal pages.
And similarly, the ones that appear to be sponsored either by a pharmaceutical,
company, yeah,
or by even, I don't know, any company that's trying to
sell you a
product.
A treatment center, you know, come to us for your hip replacement. You know, if they're making money at it, you know, you got to be concerned.
So those are really the major issues. So as I said, we will have the links on our website to some of these organizations. How about things like, there are a couple of sites I came across, like PubMed, for example, or there's a clinicaltrials.gov site.
Yes.
Are those generally
They are.
Reliable?
In fact, the information that you'll find in Medline Plus comes from PubMed.
I see.
And the difference is that PubMed is more of the professional site, and what you do is you find all the journal articles.
So you might have, a harder time
understanding,
navigating,
yes,
and making sense of it.
Yes.
But basically, the points you've made are crucial. Know who's written the site, know how credible the information, how recently it's been updated, figure out if there's a motivation behind it. And then, of course, always, always go to your healthcare team.
Yes.
And one last thing, people can go to the library. Can they actually go to your library?
Yes.
I think that's a very hidden and little known fact.
The Upstate Health Sciences Library is open to the public. Not only do we have our main health sciences library, but we offer two family resource centers, one in our Golisano Children's Hospital and one in the Cancer Center.
Fabulous. Very crucial
information. You can call us and you can visit us in person. You can email us. We never charge. You can ask us all of your questions. It is confidential.
Wow.
And we will respond to you and to you. You know, and your concerns.
What an amazing resource. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We'll have that those pieces of information as to how to contact you also on our website. My guest has been Christina Pope. She's the director of the Health Sciences Library at Upstate Medical University. Next up, syphilis is on the rise. Why should we worry? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Although syphilis was nearly eliminated from the United States about a decade ago, this sexually transmitted disease has resurged in recent years, mainly due to a rise in cases among gay and bisexual men. That's according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Well, here with a local perspective on the rise of this disease is Dr. Indu Gupta. She's Onondaga County Commissioner of Health. Welcome, Dr. Gupta. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So we're seeing an uptick in syphilis nationwide. Help us understand that. What's going on?
So syphilis is not a new disease. It's a pretty old disease. As far as 14th century, it was actually noted to be first time.
That is old.
Right. Outbreak was noted first in Naples, Italy, when there was a French invasion. So it's not something new. But it has like a waxing and waning. There was no typical treatment. In recent history, we have data going back from 1941, and we have kept track of it. When there was a very high upsurge at the time, and with the advent of penicillin, which actually can cure the disease, it started to shown quite significant improvement.
And in fact, I think I said in the introduction, it was virtually eliminated.
Right.
So why is it resurging? What's going on?
Right. So in 2000, late 1999 and 2000, CDC actually thought it's near elimination, but unfortunately, the rate started to rise. The lowest was seen was 2000. And the reason, it is difficult to say, mostly it could be that people, it's sort of a forgotten disease that people are not aware, awareness is gone. And also we have new smartphone apps that might have increased chances of having people meeting with each other for casual sex that might have also been a cause of that.
So who is basically being affected? In other words, I read somewhere that the rate in women has decreased for the most part, but it's really resurgent in males and men who are either gay or bisexual, men having sex with men. Tell us about that.
So that's correct. Locally also we have seen the same national trend. It used to be mainly male and female, both disease. Now actually it's leaned towards mainly predominantly in males and in also males, men having sex with men. That's what we define as MSM, gay and bisexual men. In locally, we have 95% who are in the male population. It's still 5%. It's a small percentage, but still it's significant in female population.
So it still does exist in females,
yes.
But it's much lower.
Yes.
So are there, in terms of a national picture, are there geographical trends? Has it started somewhere in the country, as many things do?
Right. So it started mainly in South first, and then now actually West has taken over as the first. Then it moved to Midwest, then to Northeast, and of course in Northeast, Onondaga County is not unique also. So we have started to see these rates spike for last couple of years quite significantly, actually.
Are there racial commonalities? In other words, are there particular populations, besides it being male, that you're seeing?
So national trend, usually you will see African-American, Hispanic, depending on which geographic location you're seeing, including Native American and Hawaiian. In our local Onondaga County, we are seeing a lot in Caucasians. It is present in African Americans, but it's not that typical trend as we see nationally.
Just briefly give us a feeling for what exactly syphilis is, though. We're talking about it, and it is an old disease. And just give us an overview. I mean, I know it's a bacterial infection.
Right.
And as you alluded to, something like penicillin is an effective treatment.
Right.
But what does it do to the body? And how, first of all, it's transmitted only through sexual act.
Right. So syphilis is, as you know, is a sexually transmitted disease caused by a bacteria called Treponema pallidum. It is the reason we get concern in Trump's because it starts as a local disease, as which we call primary syphilis. And if it's left untreated, it can result in systemic infection, and that's how we started to see the problem, which is called secondary syphilis. So in primary syphilis, you will see usually a ulcer, which is called chancre, and that's very highly vascular, ulcerated area, which increases the transmission of even the HIV, which has been an increasing concern with the rising rates of syphilis. If left untreated, the ulcer will heal itself, but the disease still stays and the person is very infectious. Now, it leads into secondary syphilis, in which the person presents as a systemic sign, fever, rash, lymph node enlargement, not feeling well, or hair loss, just like, you know, not good, essentially.
So basically it affects multi-systems.
That's correct. And then if it's left untreated again, it will just become quiescent. So that's what we call third, is a latent stage. So the disease is there, but it's still, but it's not showing any signs. And if it's left untreated, then it becomes tertiary syphilis. So tertiary syphilis is the one which you end up seeing all the end organ damage, like a nervous system, cardiovascular system.
You can have dementia.
Vessels, dementia. Yes. One thing also important to remember is neurosyphilis is a separate entity which can be seen at any stages. And what we are seeing more if somebody has underlying HIV also, that that increases the chance of having neurosyphilis. So it is very important to remember because this is a systemic sign of infection.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Onondaga County Health Commissioner Dr. Indu Gupta, and we're talking about the rise in syphilis. So what is happening specifically in Onondaga County? Have we seen a major rise?
That's correct. So just to give you a perspective, I will give you some number, local number. In 2008, which we had three cases. So it seems like a three case. It's a small number, yes. So comparison with the state, and we actually exclude when we compare the state with the New York City because New York City is always an outlier and is the one of the highest rate in the New York State, and then compare with the U.S. So it will give you a little bit perspective. So when we are talking three cases, and when we compare it with what we call three cases in 100 people will be a lot different than in 300,000 people, right?
Right.
So we have to look in the context of the population. So when we compare per 100,000, that's how we describe it, that this is the syphilis rate, not the absolute number, rate per 100,000. So three cases means they were 0.7 per 100,000 cases, as compared to New York State in 2008 was 2.6. excluding New York City. And at that same time, U.S. has 4.4. Going fast forward, 2010, we had 10 cases. And counties rate increased from 0.7 to 2.2 per 100,000. At the same time, our New York State rate was 2.4, so we are kind of leveling off now. And the U.S. rate, because South and West had higher rate, it was still higher, 4.5. Going forward, 2012, that rate from 10 to became 12, absolute number. So you see 5 cases, but then our rate jumped from 2.2 to 3.2. We are even with the New York State and getting close to the U.S. 2013, we doubled almost, from 15 to 29. Now our rate became 3.2 to 6.2, so that's a pretty jump. Yeah. And then subsequent year, 2004, we have 56 cases, again doubling, right?
2014. So basically from 2008, where you had 3 cases,
right?
You in 2014, you had 56 cases. That's a pretty high percentage.
That's pretty. And last 2 subsequent years, we are having almost quadruple,
doubling,
which is a very big concern because something is happening, and we really need to address that. That's how we became quite concerned about it.
So we know that there is treatment for this, but you said it's so worrisome because people either don't recognize that they have the disease, they don't know about it, there's ignorance, and continue to spread it.
That's correct.
So what basically, I mean, first of all, what are the precautions and the preventions that need to be undertaken now to put a stop to this?
Right. So the best thing we can do, the good part of this disease is it's a very preventable and a completely curable disease if it's detected earlier. Once the damage is done, you cannot reverse it. We are talking later part of the tertiary syphilis and when the end organ damage has done. What we do is we use prevention. So prevention is by having safer sex practices. That is very important.
Education
is the very important part of it because education empowers. A lot of people are not aware syphilis is on the rise. And this is something can be done. Individual offices, health department also does this, community-based organization like ACR or many other local organization has been doing it. Because they can reach out since the predominant population at this point is a male population, men having sex with men, that and gay population. So some of those specifically go. Having said that, provider's role is so important in that having a taken a detailed, non-judgmental sexual history. It's so key to reach out to your patient because people get very scared. You know, nobody wants to discuss that. And it seems like it's not a discussion of sex. It's a discussion of health.
Yes.
It's so important
Absolutely.
For people to remember.
So screening is also important.
That's correct.
In other words, testing for the disease.
Right.
So tell us about that very briefly. Who should be tested? Who are the high-risk populations that should be tested? And how... You know, how frequently do they need to be tested and what's the best methodology to get this done?
So usually there are certain what we call high-risk populations, so pregnant females. Why pregnant females? Because it has consequences for the unborn child. So it's very important to, and we have started to see the rise all over of the congenital syphilis, which seems... defeating the purpose of the treatment. So this is something locally we don't have it, but New York State does have some cases, including rest of the United States.
Where fetuses have been exposed
to
syphilis.
To the syphilis, and they have consequences later on in life, you know, developmental delay and their teeth problem. They have a lot of things which actually affects them.
So are you suggesting that all pregnant women be screened for
That's
syphilis?
That's correct. So pregnant females, in the first antenatal visit, they should all be screened. If that's a high-risk population, they should be screened later on, like 28 weeks, and at the time of delivery also, because it's very important to have that.
I don't want to run out of time. Who else should be screened?
So it should be the people who have high-risk population, especially, again, we are talking about MSM,
men
gay and bisexual, and also whose partner have been diagnosed positive in the past. Recent past, within usually we call it 90 days. That's very important.
And how about
commercial
people?
Workers?
Yes.
Sex workers. It's very important to do that.
So if people are commercial sex workers,
right.
They should really be screened as
That's
well.
That's correct.
So the whole concept here is that prevention is is crucial in terms of precaution and safe sex and understanding the use of condoms and understanding the importance, just like with HIV, that this is a sexually transmitted disease and it has very serious consequences. And early detection and early screening or screening is crucial to prevent its spread.
That's correct.
So very briefly, in the couple seconds we have left, what's the health department doing?
So health department does a very important part. So it isn't it's a notifiable disease. It means the providers and the labs are supposed to be notifying us. This is by public health law. Why? Because it's a spread by sexually transmitted. So what we do is we started to do what we call contact investigation and contact tracing. So how many people this individual had been in contact with before, and we go back and trace all the contact so we can do bring them to early diagnostic test, also recommend treatment.
So you can begin to
spread the disease, to stop the spread of the disease.
Basically. So right now, Onondaga County Health Department has free confidential testing at its STD center.
That's correct.
And in the basement of the Civic Center.
Right.
And they can reach, for getting information, 435-3236.
That's correct. Testing can be done in providers' offices. Of course, our STD center in the room 80 basement is always available. Planned Parenthood, family planning, we all do that. So it's very important to have and to get it early detection so that treatment can be administered at that point.
Thank you so much. This is very important information. My guest has been Dr. Indu Gupta, Onondaga County Commissioner of Health. As I said, the only way to stop it is to find it.
That's correct.
Thank you so much. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, Vexing Perplexing You, or Curious and Curiouser. Well, folks, I have a memory from a movie I saw as a child. The scene? A dark, tangled jungle. The characters? Two men. The action? A running fight. Then one man stepped into quicksand. He flailed and cursed, but sank down until his mouth was just above the sand, still cursing the other man. Recently, I woke in darkest night, and my mind, which had been minding its own business sleeping, woke and ran me into the cognitive quicksand of a relationship problem. Stuck, stuck, stuck. Soon my arms were tangled about my head with my face pruned up, a prune with a tension headache. I laid like that who knows how long until I realized I was in a vexing, perplexing story of my own making. Not that there aren't real problems in my life, but the can't get out of it idea is usually much worse than the problem itself. If only I could stop flailing and can't get out, I might get a new perspective and regain my footing. What to do? Short term, first, notice we're in this mental quicksand because our minds are so automatic, we don't even notice what we're up to a lot of the time. Then, get curious about what thoughts are making up the quicksand. A hint, if we can't hear anything in our head besides, I'm right, you're wrong, we've slipped into it. In fact, that I'm right, you're wrong is itself a good part of it. Second, remember that sinking, stinking, thinking is just that and nothing more, just thoughts. Then calm ourselves, shifting my attention from my steaming thoughts to my breath. In, out, helps. Until my mind is an object of my observation and less a driver of blind aggression. Then here's the really hard part. Getting curious about the other person's, that's right, the stupid jerk's point of view. To do this, we must temporarily put aside our desire to be understood and acknowledged. No easy task. And listen. It's a little harder if we're calm. Then acknowledge what we hear, preferably without expecting anything in return. Remember, understanding and acknowledging the other's point of view might open to mutual understanding. Emphasis on the might, since he or she is also flailing about in their own quicksand. Long term, know we all have blind spots. Then look for a pattern in our own conflicts. Can't see any? Not to worry. We're blind to our own repetitive boo-boos, remember? If we're ready, seek out someone we trust who will give us real feedback about our blind spots. That new information might be a hand back to solid ground. Good luck. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up next, all about stroke and its comprehensive treatment. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of March 29th. Don't be late to hydrate. While thirst is a generally good indicator of hydration, summertime heat combined with physical activity can lead to dehydration and other related illnesses. Aim for 15 to 20 ounces of water 2 hours before exercise and have a water bottle with you during your workouts. Stay hydrated this week by getting into the water bottle habit. Carry yours with you full time to quench your thirst throughout the day. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Medical professionals say time is brain. So when a patient displays stroke-like symptoms, it's critical to rapidly confirm the symptoms, but also identify the type of stroke, its location, and the extent of brain damage, as treatment decisions really hinge on all these issues. We'll hear with more on all of this is Dr. Carmen Martinez, Assistant Professor of Clinical Neurology and part of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Upstate Medical University, and registered nurse Catherine Stevens. She's Assistant Director of Nursing and the Stroke Program Administrator at Upstate Medical University as well. Thank you both for coming in.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
So, when someone is having a stroke, how do we know? Kathy, what are the signs and symptoms of stroke?
Well, we ask that patients and members of the community watch for signs and symptoms using an acronym, FAST. So if you have noticed somebody or yourself having problems with the face, we look for a droop on one side of the face. We also look for A, arms, meaning their arm is, or their weakness in the arm. Is there difficulty, S, with speech? And then lastly, trying to remember that time is brain. So we ask you that you remember FAST and try to get to the hospital quickly by calling 911. There are other signs and symptoms of stroke, such as dizziness and confusion and sudden onset of very severe headache that are also big warning signs. But FAST does cover the majority of most strokes that patients would need to get to the hospital.
That's a key acronym. Dr. Martinez, why is it so important? We've been alluding to this idea of time is brain. Why is it so important to do this quickly?
Time is very critical because when you have an acute stroke, there is some medication that can be given to the patient. And there is a very specific time window within which this medication can be provided to the patient in order to decrease the disability that this patient may have while he's having a stroke.
Okay, we're going to talk specifically about the kinds of treatments, but very quickly, what should the patient do then, Dr. Martinez?
The thing that I tell the patients and the family members is, as soon as you start having any of the symptoms of a stroke, so the onset of weakness, numbness, difficulty speaking, difficulty swallowing, kindly look at the clock, see what time it is, so we know it's very critical for us to know when was the last time that the patient was known well, or when was the time that the symptoms started, because we have, for most of the patients, 3 hours in order to intervene. And sometimes we can extend that for the clotbuster medication up to 4.5 hours.
So for clotbusters, for 4.5, we'll get to that. But the point is, they need to, if they think they are experiencing a stroke, as Kathy pointed out with FAST, they should look at the clock or look at their watch, and have someone should help define when it started, so that you have some sense of the parameters of time.
That is essential.
So how what should they do? Should they go right to 911, and should they ever transport themselves? Catherine, should they ever transport themselves directly to a stroke center?
Absolutely, to call 911. What's important about calling 911 is that EMS is able to provide our specialized emergency medical providers can be right on the scene and start treatment and get things moving quickly, so that when the patient is transported to our emergency department, we're already waiting there, ready to take care of them.
What happens, Dr. Martinez, on arrival to a designated stroke center like yours?
Well, I can speak for our institution. What we do is, as soon as we get notified that there is a patient with a possible stroke syndrome, what we do is that we activate a very organized pathway where there is a stroke code that is activated immediately. A neurology physician is already in the ER waiting for the patient, or readily available to examine the patient. From that moment, after the patient is examined, there are many things that are going on at the same time. The nurses are getting all the IVs. The patient is taking blood samples, because there are many things that has to happen at that particular
to help with the diagnosis of where it's
yes,
located, what kind of stroke.
The patient goes immediately to the CAT scan. And once we have all that information available, which is only a couple of minutes.
Really?
yes.
That is rapid.
Yes. We get everything done, blood samples, neurology physician evaluation, CAT scan, immediate CAT scan evaluation, because we have to determine if this is an ischemic stroke or if this is a hemorrhagic stroke, meaning that a blood vessel burst, and that patient has a completely different pathway of evaluation and treatment.
So a blockage is different than a burst vessel.
Yes.
And that is how you make the distinction, and that's important in terms of the treatment path.
Yes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, here with neurologist Dr. Carmen Martinez and registered nurse Catherine Stevens. We're talking about stroke. So what makes a place, either a designated stroke center or, in your case, a comprehensive stroke program?
Certainly. So there are some very fine primary stroke centers in the throughout the country, and certainly in our area. There needs to be, in order to become a comprehensive stroke center, there needs to be a coordinated care that you would be able to provide from the very onset when the patient arrives through all possible treatments, up to and including things such as interventional therapies, where we can actually go into the blood vessel, remove the clot, open up that vessel so that the brain that's not getting enough oxygen will get it. So those are things that we're ready and able to do as part of this comprehensive care. And we have a pathway that takes the patient, just as Dr. Martinez so eloquently put, we can get the patient through to those therapies if that is what's necessary once we have our treatments. Additionally, comprehensive stroke centers have three, in our case, we have three levels of neuroscience-specific care. So we have a 14-bed neuroscience ICU, and a 13-bed intermediate care level, a 19-bed floor with telemetry capabilities, as well as over 200 nurses that work in those areas. We have interventional radiology nurses and ED nurses, and all of them are trained in the specialized care of stroke. It's a pretty big undertaking to make sure that you've given education to that large of a team. And we have over 20 neurologists who specialize in the care of stroke. So that's a really big plus as well. And additionally, we have an acute care rehab right on the premises. So we're able to take the patient from the time the incident occurs through the very rigorous rehab that can can happen to help the patient return to their best
so it is
possible
truly,
state.
It is truly comprehensive.
It really
and
is.
And it's multidisciplinary.
Oh,
it sounds
absolutely.
Like you have all kinds of rehab people as well as neurologists and nurses and interventional radiologists, basically representing the whole gamut
absolutely.
Of and subspecialties you would need.
We have our pharmacist is on call, and the CAT scan technicians are on call, and part of that stroke team and stroke code, as well as spiritual care. We make sure that our spiritual care providers actually respond to the stroke codes because the family really is so distraught at that time, and we want to make sure that we're providing for them as well.
That's incredibly important.
Agreed.
Dr. Martinez, you mentioned very eloquently just a few minutes ago the differences are key in terms of the type of stroke, in terms of treatment. Just briefly give us an overview of what's the difference with a clot that's caused the stroke versus a hemorrhage that's caused the stroke.
There are two different types of strokes. One is when you have a clot that is obstructing the flow to a particular part of the brain. And the other one is where a particular blood vessel completely bursts and you start bleeding into your brain. The signs are basically indistinguishable for the patient. The major difference is that maybe one can have more headache than the other, but it doesn't matter. Just if you have any type of neurological symptoms, please, please call 911. Look at the clock, call 911 immediately, and don't try to drive. You can get stuck in traffic. There are many things that could happen. Just call 911, and we will be here in upstate. We're going to be able to provide the best quality of care that you can have if you're having a stroke.
If you have a clot, what do you do for that person?
What we do is that we have, as I explained, the treatment options. We can have the clot buster medication, and that's the determination that we make right after the CAT scan.
So you do the testing, you find out there's a clot, you give them clot buster medication, and that can dissolve the clot. And
it may dissolve the clot, but the care doesn't stop there. We keep following that patient, and then based on our clinical examination with the neurology physician is in the ER and is evaluating the patient, we can make a determination if this is this may be a small clot or if this is an occlusion of a large artery in the brain, because in that way, if that is the situation, this patient can have an endovascular treatment, which basically consists of putting a catheter in one of your arteries and trying to go to where the clot is located and disrupting that.
Actually, so, physically disrupting
yes,
the clot,
so
not
the,
just medic, not just using medication.
Yes. So, well, there are different types. I'm not going to get into that, but basically what the point that we want or the goal is to destroy that clot and reperfuse the brain.
Okay, I don't want to run out of time. We just have a few seconds left. If it's a hemorrhage, what do you do real quick?
If it's a hemorrhage, this patient is immediately evaluated. He's transferred to the ICU. There is a huge neurosurgery department that is available to provide the medical care that this patient have.
So they might have need surgical intervention, but basically, by doing all these things as quickly as you do and as carefully as you do, you can prevent a lot of subsequent brain damage that often came with stroke for years and years.
And a lot
and
of that is provided in the neuro ICU. Where
yes.
They...
And I would like to say that our goal is to take that patient who unfortunately had a stroke, to put this patient back to what he was doing before.
Well,
that's our major goal.
I'm sure that's everybody's goal, and certainly the patient's goal and the family's goal. And I thank you so much for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Carmen Martinez. She is Assistant Professor of Clinical Neurology and part of the Comprehensive Stroke Team at Upstate Medical University, and registered nurse Catherine Stevens. Also, she's the administrator for the stroke program at the Upstate Medical University as well. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. A poem can appear to be so simple on the page, yet it can contain layers of meaning and a range of emotions. Listen to the story poet Laura Glenn, a writer from Ithaca, New York, weaves in her poem Shred. She's describing an adult daughter helping her aging father destroy his patient files as he and his wife prepare to move. Shred. Dad hands me a confidential paper. Together, we turn bipolar disorders into a snow of confetti. It blows onto the garden of rug. We switch blades. I destroy suicidal impulses, cut self-destructive tendencies to ribbons, blithely make fortunes you could tuck into cookies from obsessions and compulsions, crank spaghetti out of eating disorders, toss word salads in the garbage. Our progress slowed by his cloudy eyes, lingering on each page before he hands it to me to destroy blindly. My father has always been excellent about confidentiality. I never quite grasped what he did for a living until I was sent to one. So actually, I have no idea what we're shredding, all the forbidden subjects. I could snatch a few strands, stuff them in my pocket later, paste them together, randomly, like a Dadaist poet. Maybe he knows what I'm thinking. Above the clamor, he jokes that he could shred me. I tell my Dada, who loves puns, I could be a cut-up. Then it's back to business. I want him to know he can trust me. I shred another paper, helping my parents clear out the old house they're too old to manage. While I'm with my father in his office, tearing life stories to shreds, my mother's in the bedroom, shedding reams of tears.
For joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when, in honor of Public Health Week, we explore stress and how to manage it. Plus, we'll have author Harriet Brown with us to talk about her newest book, The Body of Truth, and our culture's preoccupation with weight, and how to avoid those deadly peanut allergies in children. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Conjol and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.